Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think we can get started. My name is Cosmas Zavazava. I think you have got the booklet with you. I'm going to be the moderator of this session, which is a high-level debate session on the use of information and communication technologies in disaster management. I think we have got radio amateurs in the room, like Hans Zimmerman over there. And this Morse code is very familiar to them. SOS, that's where it all began. Telecommunications can save lives in terms of disasters. We have got a distinguished panel. I'm going to give them the privilege of introducing themselves, but I have the obligation, protocol calls, that I should introduce the director of the Telecommunication Development Bureau, Sami Al-Bashir, and he is going to give us opening remarks. We might be joined later on, and he will introduce the Minister of Pakistan. So I give the floor to the director before we introduce the panelists. Yes.
Thank you, Cosmos, and I think all of you know Cosmos very well. He's very active in this field, and I will surprise him and just announce, which is unusual. We usually don't praise ourselves in the meetings, but this is a special occasion. Cosmos just been awarded yesterday as the BDT on the ITU level, the ITU award for his dedicated work, especially in the area of emergency communication and in other fields. And I'm very proud of him. I count on him, I rely on him. And that's why I chose him to do even more duties within the BDT, including emergency communication. So thank you, Cosmos. This is, by coincidence, a good occasion to start this meeting. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, as Cosmos said, we have a distinguished panelist here, so, and also very important people in the room, all of you, from all our stakeholders, from civil society, business, and, of course, our members, the governments. And so for that reason, my remarks will be very, very short. I would like to welcome you all to the WISIS Forum 2010 and to this high-level debate on the ICT for disaster management. This year started in a bad note, unfortunately. On the 12th of January, an earthquake struck Haiti with a magnitude of 7 on the Richter scale and killed over 225,000 people, displaced over 1 million people, and destroyed infrastructure worthy millions of dollars. On 27th of February, another earthquake struck Chile with a magnitude of 8.8, which means that it was 500 times more intense than the event in Haiti. April 4th witnessed an earthquake of a magnitude of 7.2, striking Mexico near the borders over the border with California. This was followed by a weaker 7.2 magnitude earthquake that struck the province in central China that killed over 1,700 people. This list goes on, and we all remember the misery caused by the Iceland volcano during the past few weeks. And when we wrote the speech, we said the past few weeks, but it's still going. Now it's affecting North Africa, Morocco, and other countries. The role of technology in monitoring, predicting, and detecting disasters has become very important. Through ICTs, disasters can be mitigated through early warning systems. When the disaster strikes, we can use ICT to coordinate search and rescue operations and deliver essential services such as telemedicine to victims, as you all know. Our goal is to ensure that ICT are universally accessible to all citizens, and this is the spirit behind the WISIS to create the information society. From a development perspective, we are taking measures to ensure that broadband is accessible to all and that broadband infrastructure does not just roll out national high-speed network accessible for all citizens, for boosting economic growth, but also to deliver life-saving solutions. I wish you a successful deliberation. Of course, we will hear from our panelists and from the experts in this room for the next 2 hours or so. This is a very, very important topic, and I would like to just emphasize that the Secretary General, myself, all the elected officials are putting this topic on the top of our agenda. And we are proud that partners around the world, when they see a disaster strike anywhere, whether it's earthquake or otherwise, they automatically look to the ITU to partner with. And we thank you for that. And we thank you for your presence this morning. And I will turn the floor back to my colleague, the moderator, Mr. Cosmo Zavazava, to continue the session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The format of this session is going to be a little bit flexible. What we are going to do, we are basically going to introduce the panelists. They will introduce themselves so that nothing is lost in translation. Thereafter, we are going to give them about 5 minutes to make presentations, and we are going to define the theme and the direction of the discussion. And after that, we are going to open the floor. We would like it to be a lively debate, and we hope that the session will not be a disaster in itself. So please relax and feel free, and let's have fun. So if you have any questions or any comments, just feel free. I will begin from here, from Kelly O'Keefe. Please, if you can introduce yourself.
Thank you, Cosmos. I'm Kelly O'Keefe, and I'm here today representing Iridium Satellite, which is a major provider of global satellite voice and data solutions. We've been working with ITU in the framework for international cooperation and disasters, and I also serve as the rapporteur of question 22-2 in the ITU development sector, which works on emergency communications issues. Thank you. Thank you.
Dean Calora, Director of Calabria Software. Unfortunately, Mark Moore could not make it, since his apologies. We've developed a secure, interoperable communication solution, currently doing some work with the ITU and looking forward to helping as many as we can. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning. I'm Seppo Sisetto. I'm here on behalf of Amateur Radio Society, and here is a sign that something about GAREC. I think that most of you have never heard about GAREC. That's a Global Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Conference. We have organized those since 2005 every year, and this year in October it will be in Curaçao, 11th to 12th of October, just a day after the independence of the island. So that's one thing. And basically, my background goes to journalism and media. And 19 years ago, I got first time in my life involved with emergency communications when we organized in my hometown Tampere a conference on disaster communications. And now I would like to make a question for all of you. How many of you have heard about Tampere Convention? Not too many. I hopefully you learned something about that convention, and asking your country to sign it and to ratify it. Well, I'll go back to those.
Okay, things please, later. Next. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you. My name is Tom Wasilewski. I'm with Qualcomm, the wireless company. I've been a veteran sort of ITU participant over the years, and basically in charge of ITU relations with the ITU, and those relations have developed positively, and I'll be happy to speak more about that soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Daniel Stauffacher. I am a former diplomat. I was ambassador of Switzerland for organizing the first phase of the World Summit on Information Society with some of our friends here on the early days in 2001, starting our work. I'm now the chairman of the ICT for Peace Foundation, which is a think tank
which I will explain later, came out of the World Summit on Information Society. Thank you very much.
Estraya.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Amin Alamari. I'm representing here Thuraya Telecommunications, which is a major satellite provider.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Steve Buckley. I have the privilege of serving as president of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, which is an international grassroots association. It brings together a network of around 4,000 community radios worldwide in 117 countries.
Thank you. Jenai.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Emanuele Jenai. I studied in Geneva as an environmental geologist. I wanted to mention this because this is also where Dr. Kofi Annan studied. So not that I want to be compared with Dr. Kofi Annan, but just to recognize that University of Geneva was is certainly a place where people can get together and do huge, huge things. I work for ESRI, Environmental Systems Research Institute. It's a geographic information systems, or GIS, company based in California and having offices all over the world. It's a global company. And again, I thank you, Dr. Zavazava, for your invitation today.
Thank you very much. Let me put this session into context, first of all. We have a very diversified team here. We have got people dealing with mapping, geographical information systems, beginning from there. We have got satellite operators. We have civil society. We have got the other team giving you a legal perspective in terms of the Tampere Convention. We have got satellite operating companies, and we have got software for the harmonization of telecommunication systems in terms of disaster. So you are going to get the technology side, technological side, you are going to get the legal side, the regulatory side, you are going to get the standard operating procedure side of things. Technology is useless, and I think you will agree with me, if it is not applied. So we need technology to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. We need technology to achieve the WISIS targets and objectives by year 2015. It all began in 1991 when negotiations started to come up with the first treaty ever, which is now known as the Tampere Convention. Negotiations were long and odious, and they were fortunately successful in the end. In 1998, an agreement was reached on this treaty, and there is a provision there that says that when 30 members accede to this agreement or ratify the agreement, then the agreement would come into effect. It took a long time. It only took the tsunami, by coincidence, by the way, to have the Tampere Convention to come into effect on the 8th of January 2005. Thereafter, 18 to 22 January 2005 was key because the international community met in Hyogo Prefecture in Japan. And there was the World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction. After that, you know, following the tsunami, unfortunately, the Minister of Pakistan is not here. Immediately, there was a huge earthquake on the Kashmir border, and hundreds of people died. What followed is just history. And in one incident alone, a country can lose over $20 billion. A case in point is that of Myanmar. When they had Cyclone Nargis, they lost $25 billion in just a nick of time. China, the same thing when the Sichuan earthquake struck. The rest of the disasters you have already heard from the director. That is the way it is. And we know disaster risk reduction is one of the key elements because studies have indicated that for every $1 that we put in disaster preparedness or risk reduction, we tend to save about 14 to 15 US dollars when disasters do strike. So I'm going to open the floor now. And I see that the minister, the honorable minister is here. I will hand over the floor to the director before I give our panelists an opportunity to make comments.
Well, thank you, Cosmos, and I'd like to welcome His Excellency, the Minister of Communication of Pakistan, who was with us yesterday in another session, and we have the honor to have him now. You know, Pakistan is a special country, and I will let him talk about this briefly. Cosmos, the moderator, our colleague, was just mentioning and giving an example of the earthquake which struck Pakistan in 2005 and how this whole process started and so on. So it's my honor to introduce His Excellency to say a few words to the meeting before we continue with our panelists. Your Excellency, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President and members of the Presidium, ladies and gentlemen. I'm indeed honored to be amongst the illustrious lot of the world here. And as you know, we are today discussing about the disaster management, and disaster management, obviously, these days, as we all know, we are facing this calamity, started off at various places, and unfortunately Pakistan was equally stricken and stricken very hard and taken absolutely unaware. We were absolutely unprepared for that. It was a calamity of a very high magnitude, in which I think we had the highest loss in terms of human lives, apart from the infrastructure which was damaged. But I must say that Pakistan is a very resilient nation and a very resilient country, despite the many problems that we were facing, the influx of refugees from Afghanistan and so many other problems. We were able to unite as a nation, but on top of it, I must compliment the international community. The international community came up with a very strong and a humane approach, and the United Nations and other countries all flooded into Pakistan with all types of humanitarian assistance, and apart from the assistance in terms of what the needs of the people and what the calamity-stricken people of that area needed. We were very short in many terms. We were not, prepared for that. There were people who were buried under the debris, and there were people who remained there for days and days and days, and they were we didn't have even the apparatus to dig out and to pull out them from the debris. And you can imagine the human misery and the colossal loss that the sufferance took was ignited over there. But I think one thing which emerged out of it is that once again the global community stood up to the task, and they showed that it was in fact indeed a global village, and the pangs and pains and sufferings, whether they were in the remotest areas of Pakistan or anywhere in the globe, I think they thought that they themselves were suffering that agony and pain and that disaster. And the lessons that we learned out of the disaster management, I can briefly say is that this actually took place on the 8th of October 2005. And then thereafter, the government of Pakistan established a National Disaster Management Authority. And the National Disaster Management Authority now is the central body for the disaster management and control. And the lessons that we learned in the ICT sector, related sector, were that the buildings, housings, the telecommunication infrastructure were of non-seismic built out design. Since we were not prepared for that, therefore we had to go in for evaluating the seismic zones within the realm of our country, so that we could thereafter plan in a way that we could ask our people not to lay the infrastructure and not to build towns and not to be concentrated more in the seismic zones. And even in the seismic zones, we came out with structural designs meant to absorb that seismic, the jolts and the vibrations that the seismic zone would have brought about, so that in the variation, in the vibrations and in the flexibility, they could withstand that pressure. Then there was lack of proper network monitoring system to assess the scale of damage in that short period. So we have also learned that lesson, and the telecom network was not ready to deal with the traffic volume in a disaster situation. So we also have got this lesson, and telecom therefore was able to network it now, and we are now working on that. So far as the telecom role for the disaster management, we also could be, that can be prevented or at least mitigated through the early warning systems. Now, telecommunication satellites can be built, radar and telemetry, meteorology and remote sensing. Of course, there are two ways. One is the traditional way, that is the radio, the television, the telephony, and then the modern ways that we can go to SMS cells, and then broadcastings and internet. And so there also, I think we have to have a united policy and a strategy whereby we can forestall and we can mitigate and minimize, of course, the natural disasters, the natural calamities on it. Nobody's prowess, that is what we say, is ordained by God, but then it is for man also, and God has given this prowess to man also to forestall and to stem and to mitigate the damage, and damage control can is possible and is being very effectively carried out. For example, if you see in the United States, the damage to wherever it takes place, the disaster management, although it takes place anywhere, even in the superpower, it is also not forestalled from disaster management. But life loss in terms of human life is the minimal over there, because all these alerts and all these alarms are given much earlier, and evacuation takes place, which is not done in these parts of the world. Telecommunications can also be used as a conduit for disseminating information on the impending danger, thus making it possible for people to take necessary precautions to mitigate the impact of these disasters. And when disaster eventually strikes, coordination of relief work by national entities as well as the international community is now made possible. So the requirements of emergency telecommunication networks is, number one, accessibility, I would say, accessible from all locations by multiple modes. Then the network priority, on the network priority over all our non-emergency communications. Then is the mobility, third. Mobility and redeployment must be where it is most needed. Then universal connectivity. Local, regional and international connectivity can be done. And then availability must be robust, reliable, and provide high network availability. Now, the major areas of emergency communications are the communications from citizens to authorities and organizations. There are emergency calls, and we can have communication between authorities, organizations, that is public safety communications, and then communication from authorities and organizations to citizens, and that is the warning systems, and then communication amongst citizens during the emergencies. So I think these special software packages built for the purpose can be used for registering the missing persons again, because that is another source where the whole community gets involved, and people who are either lost or under the debris, buried or not available or run away for out of scare, then they also, their relatives and the whole community is very scared, and that also can be done. Then administering on online requests and keeping the track of relief organizations or camps of displaced persons. In addition, geographic information system and remote sensing software can be effectively undertaken and used in all the phases of disaster management. So I think these are this today's subject is very important and germane to ameliorate the miseries of human beings wherever they are. But the one, I think, great lesson that we have learnt is that today we feel in unison with each other. our hearts and minds throb with all the people wherever in the globe they are. Now people sitting anywhere, even in the most advanced countries of the world, be they with the superpowers or anybody, they have the same concerns for anywhere people in the third world countries. And this, I think, beautifies and this brings out one thing, that we are a global community, it is a global village, and we have to progress together and feel for each other. And this is how I think we can have a better world. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Thank you, Your Excellency. I think I'm speaking on behalf of all of us here, and to thank you for sharing these thoughts about your country experience and this with us. And I think it goes without saying that the people of Pakistan and the government of Pakistan are to be praised of fighting the war on terror for the international community, and we all behind you and with you using ICT, and I think it's clear what your government is doing, and what the Pakistani people are doing is really being admired and appreciated worldwide. So thank you for this these comments, and allow me to just give you a small gift to remember this meeting and this occasion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Back to you, Kazmus, and we continue with our panel.
Thank you very much. I think I summarized. Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Authority to authority, authority to citizens, citizens to authority, citizens to citizens. That summarizes pretty much the role of telecommunications in emergencies. I give the floor to Kelly to make her opening remarks, and I think the foundation has been laid by the Honorable Minister, so the floor is yours. If you have any comments that you would like to bring up on the role of technology and in emergencies, thank you.
Thank you, Cosmas, and I want to thank the Honorable Minister as well. I think he touched upon an important point, and that we really have seen so many terrible disasters recently, but we've also seen so much support from citizens, from governments, international organizations, and also the private sector in ensuring that correct equipment or support is on hand for relief efforts. And I think from there, I will start to talk about, as I mentioned, Iridium is a mobile satellite service provider, and Iridium services are used quite frequently in support of disaster relief operations. The ITU has set up, I think a lot of you here know, and a lot of our panelists are also part of the International Framework for Cooperation in Emergencies. Through that framework, Iridium Satellite has contributed 66 mobile satellite handsets, solar batteries, and also airtime on their network to support the emergency relief efforts of the ITU. These handsets can be on hand in a disaster site within 24 to 48 hours, and they've recently been deployed in Chile, in Haiti, Tonga, and also in the earthquake in Pakistan. So we commend the ITU in helping leverage the private sector resources. I think the ITU has done a really great job of taking advantage of what the private sector has to offer and using that to help disaster relief efforts. And as I also mentioned, I am the rapporteur of the emergency communications question in the ITU development sector. So through that, Iridium has also worked through both the ITU development sector and the radio communications sector in supporting a lot of the work that the study groups and the ITU members have done in making information available for developed and developing countries about the systems and services, satellite communications systems that are available for disaster relief. Through all of the disasters that we've seen recently and the support, I know Iridium and a lot of the other partners here who have been to disaster sites, we have learned a lot of lessons. And these lessons are continuing to be learned by us. As the minister said, the disaster relief and recovery have many phases, and we learn throughout all of these phases. So I wanted to share a couple of these lessons. And one is the whole purpose that we're here today. ICTs are essential for disaster relief operations. I don't think any of us here are debating or disputing this point. It's critical to disaster management to have ICTs taken into account. And in that context, satellite services play a critical role in the immediate aftermath of a disaster. Very often, terrestrial infrastructure can be damaged or destroyed, and satellite services are available to step in with extra redundant capabilities to support disaster relief operations. Iridium has seen enormous spikes in the traffic in disaster sites in the immediate aftermath of disasters. So it's interesting to see how quickly those services are deployed when they're needed. And similarly, there are a lot of next generation mobile satellite systems. And as those are deployed, there'll be additional higher bandwidth applications, mobility, video. These are increasingly important to disaster relief efforts. And then on the flip side of that, one thing that I've seen quite a bit is, much as ICTs should be part of disaster management also needs to be part of ICT development. I think the World Summit, which is what we're here talking about today, touches upon so many areas of ensuring connectivity throughout the world. And disaster communications cuts across so many of those WSIS action lines. In terms of infrastructure development, countries everywhere we've been hearing throughout the week working on broadband deployment strategies, connectivity strategies. It's critical that disaster management or disaster communications are embedded within those strategies. They cannot be considered separately, including the role that satellite communications play. We're ensuring that there's redundant capabilities or capacities. As countries deploy broadband throughout their country, it's important to take account of the connectivity that's needed for a disaster. There's also regulatory and licensing considerations. A lot of countries here today are reviewing their regulatory licensing and spectrum management frameworks in order to meet Millennium Development Goals or fulfill WSIS implementation objectives. Disaster communications are also something that should be taken into account, making sure that regulations don't prohibit equipment that can be on the ground or the import of equipment or restrict what is available for a disaster. And similar to spectrum, ensuring that spectrum resources are available for disaster communication support and that there are adequate protections for those services that support disasters. Telemedicine is another area which I saw quite a bit as a rapporteur in my study group. There are so many connections between telemedicine and disaster relief. So as countries are looking at e-health and telehealth, to consider how these systems can also be repurposed in an emergency. And then, of course, capacity building. Capacity building touches upon so many areas. And I think Cosmos was saying before, ICTs, you can have them, but unless you use them, it's not very helpful. Similarly, you can have them, but if the people who need to use them are not trained to use them, it's also not very useful. So I urge everyone here to continue with capacity building efforts for emergency communications professionals. So I know that I won't dwell too much or continue further. I think that I've seen quite a bit in the past few years that countries are taking a hard look at disaster management requirements and working them into their plans. So I urge all of you, and I know Iridium is looking forward to working with ITU and other countries and organizations in making sure that these communications objectives and disaster management connectivity is available. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Okay, so I'm going to move a little bit. I'm going to move on to somebody who is going to talk about the legal framework, and he will teach us how to pronounce tempere, because all of us say tempere. I think Sisepo will be able to tell us exactly what the Tempere Convention is. We have heard from suppliers of technology, and we had that development and the disaster like Siamese twins. So they go hand in hand. It is useless to develop if you are not going to manage disaster management. Otherwise, everything could be destroyed within a nick of a second. So could you just give us a perspective quickly on the role of the regulatory framework and legal framework?
Yeah, thank you very much. About Tampere Convention, as I mentioned and asked you, there are, I would like to say, too many people do not know yet exactly what it is, and from a certain points of view, sometimes it's very difficult to describe, but I would like to say that Tampere Convention is very important, could be very important tool in the cases of emergencies across the borders. And as Dr. Sava mentioned, it took a long time to get it in force because the basic paper for Tampere Convention was born in 1991 in Tampere. It took 7 years to get this Tampere Convention 1998, and again 7 years to get it in force just 2 weeks after tsunami. And I think that at the moment there are some 40 countries ratified, more than 60 countries signed the Tampere Convention, and a very interesting thing in the beginning of this was was that the first conference where the basic paper was born, it was outside of all kind of authorities. It was organized mainly by Aamulehti Group, the media company in Tampere, and International Institute of Communications. Maybe sometimes it's very useful to do something outside these official organizations. But we were lucky because Dr. Tarjanne, he was Secretary General of the ITU that time, he was one of the main persons in the conference. We have also second Finn, he was Secretary General of the IFRC here in Geneva that time, and I think that we had very many good things why we finally got this process to continue and finally to get this agreement, but convention. But I think that at the moment we all should start to work for getting more countries to ratify it. 40 countries is a too small number, and on ITU's website you will find more information about the convention and how to ratify it and get this in real use, because it seems that still many countries, they have ratified, basically they have done it, but the implementation of Tampere Convention is not even halfway. It's still in the beginning, and that's why I'm asking you to learn it, what's inside, and start actions for getting your country to be involved.
Thank you very much. I think we have heard the Tampere Convention is an international treaty that came into effect in 2005. It seeks to facilitate a smooth cross-border movement of telecommunications equipment in times of disasters. So those countries that ratified the convention simply said, yes, we'll be ready, we'll put mechanisms in place so that when you bring your telecommunications resources, our customs will not delay that equipment at the border, and the people will not be delayed at immigration. Those people will be protected when they deploy. But again, the member state still has the sovereign right to reject or accept telecommunications. We have the telecommunications resources, we have the legal framework in place. We need to harmonize different kinds of telecommunication systems. And we hear from Colubria, who have got a platform that they have developed which helps to harmonize the different kinds of telecommunication networks that are in use. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much, Cosmos, and good morning to everyone again. Thank you for your time. Calabria, we began our journey into interoperable communications at first through setting up Wi-Fi networks for clients such as airports, hospitals, and school systems. And one day we're approached by an airport director who came to us and put his pen down on the table and said, you know, whenever I have an incident on the airfield, I'm calling 18, 19, 20 different agencies. Primarily it's voice only through the radio. And what can you do to help augment that, to help facilitate that process? At the time we said, well, we don't know, but we'll certainly look into it. That was a few years back. That was kind of our soft introduction to interoperable communications. Since then, we've developed and created a software, and through time of observation and study, we learned just how important the harmony of communications is between agencies. It's the difference between saving lives and property, mitigating loss. So it became a very important objective. And through incidences such as Haiti, where you've got several organizations, all different countries coming together to help in one effort, how is communication being done between those organizational lines? So we've developed a secure interoperable communications tool that augments not only voice communications, but allows for text, alerts and bulletins, file transfers. Our mission statement was simplicity. I think Ms. O'Keefe mentioned how important it was to keep staff trained and up to speed on different capacities that exist in the marketplace. So we set out to really make it as simple as possible with the vision of the software downloads into any off-the-shelf hardware, such as a laptop or desktop, in 2 minutes, and you're trained in 2 minutes. Simplicity, again, key, wanting first responders to be able to respond and not thinking how to respond became a very, very important vision of ours. We are an internet-based tool, so we would be working in collaboration with many of those sitting on the panel here today, but are excited that we are able to add value and help as many agencies as possible, countries as possible, in saving lives and harmonizing the way we communicate.
Thank you very much. We have a representative from IET, from civil society, and I apologize to him because just a few minutes ago he asked if he could show a video, and the format of this session does not kind of take into account presentations, because we want to move quickly and to make it as interactive as possible. But all the same, he's going to take the floor and share with you the experiences of Haiti. Please, the floor is yours.
Sorry, I didn't realize you were coming to me. I just need to fire up my computer here. I'm not from Haiti, I should say. I'm from the UK, but AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, has been very closely involved in the Haiti response, and I'm going to cover that, among other things, in my presentation here. First of all, let me say that I very much welcome the invitation from the ITU to take part in this debate. It's a subject of considerable importance to our organization. As I said earlier, AMARC groups together some 4,000 community radios worldwide in 117 countries. And over the years, community broadcasters in numerous countries and all regions of the world have faced the challenge of responding to disaster. Indeed, they've often been among the first responders in communities that have been affected. So I'm going to share some of the lessons we've learned about the role of communications in disaster response from the perspective of grassroots community media organizations. We are meeting just a few months after the devastating earthquake in Haiti, and it's unfortunate my friend and fellow board member of AMARC, Sonny Esteos, is not here. He's from Haiti, and I'd hope to show a short video from him in his place. Ironically, he is stuck in Miami because the volcanic ash from Iceland has affected flights through Madrid. He would have spoken from first-hand experience of when the earthquake struck. Sonny is director of Haiti's leading community media support organization, known by its acronym SACS, or the Society for the Animation of Social Communication. Their building in Port-au-Prince was totally destroyed. Sonny was in his office at the time and lucky to have escaped alive. For a week, he had almost no means of communication with the outside world. Mobile phone and internet systems were down or barely functioning, power supplies destroyed, and people preoccupied with searching for family and friends and assuring basic supplies. The earthquake in Haiti brought again to the fore not only the importance of communication when disaster strikes, but also the challenges when the impact of disaster includes the destruction of communications infrastructure. Community radio has been present in Haiti for more than 15 years and has experience in responding to previous emergencies such as floods and hurricanes, but nothing at this scale. Many media organizations suffered damage. Radio studios and transmission towers were destroyed. Others were unable to broadcast because of damage to buildings, the risk of aftershocks causing further damage, or staff being too busy engaged directly in search and rescue. AMARC organized an emergency response mission to assess the impact on Haiti's community radio sector and to provide support to community media activists. In the immediate aftermath, we found that most of the community radio stations had been remarkably resilient. And although several had suffered damage and had diminished their program output, they'd continued to broadcast, aware of the vital importance of doing so for their communities. Some had even increased their program hours to meet the evident demand. Most have made significant changes to their programming, assisting to mobilize community response, providing information on missing persons, publicizing requests for information, explaining the causes of the disaster and the risk of aftershocks, advising on precautions to take, signposting to welfare and supplies, providing psychological support, and so on. What is notable in the response of community broadcasts to disaster is that they can be a focal point for local organization, receiving as well as imparting information, working with local community leaders, facilitating dialogue, and assisting people to understand and come to terms with what has happened. They should not be considered simply as a relay for information from public agencies, but also a means by which those directly affected by disaster can engage in disaster response. This is particularly important in remote and rural communities. In Haiti, for example, much of the immediate international response focused inevitably on the capital and other urban centers of population with the greatest concentrations of people affected. Essential services were much slower to reach smaller and more isolated communities, which were consequently reliant on self-help for much of the emergency phase. Community broadcasts have learned lessons from other disasters and other parts of the world. 2 years ago, AMARC undertook a survey of community radio practice in natural disaster management. The survey brought together the experience of community broadcasters in Australia, India, Indonesia, Japan, Nepal, among others. Stations surveyed reported responding to floods, landslides, earthquakes, tsunami, and volcanic eruptions. Programming responses included information about post-disaster risks and mitigation, missing persons, logistics distribution, trauma healing, and facilitating community dialogue. Many of the stations surveyed explained their role in organizing community-level meetings and assisting to mobilize local response. The survey also sought to obtain views on how emergency response could be strengthened. Strategies included preparing a local disaster response manual, maintaining a backup power generator, having a building resistant to disaster, training of staff to deal with disaster response. Access to mobile phones and internet were considered important, but also the means to produce and distribute printed materials, such as posters and leaflets. In the rehabilitation and reconstruction phase, the participatory and interactive nature of community media takes on further importance. Affected communities need the means to speak out and to have their concerns heard. They need to be consulted about the reconstruction process and engaged in its implementation.
public authorities and international agencies need to demonstrate transparency, including by being accountable through the media. Psychological recovery can be assisted by carrying the testimonies of those affected, engaging expert advice, and facilitating dialogue. Special attention needs to be given to vulnerable groups, women, children, the elderly, and the disabled. So finally, let me suggest, in summing up, that it can be useful to frame the communication needs of disaster-affected communities in terms also of communication rights. Traditional approaches to disaster response have tended to treat those affected as passive victims, which can lead to a double disaster. First, the natural disaster, and then the displacement of local economies and social relations with the disaster industry. A rights-based approach starts from the recognition that the people most affected by disaster are also the most important agents of recovery. Their communication rights of voice and expression of opinion, of access to information, of transparency and accountability of public agencies, and of the means of dialogue within and with the community are also the means by which other rights to food, water, shelter, health, economic opportunities, etc., can be asserted and defended. Community media provide one of the tools by which the communication rights of disaster-affected communities can be assured. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I give the floor to Qualcomm. They claim to be the fathers of CDMA, third generation networks. We entered into a partnership agreement, as we did with the rest of them, but I think what is special is that when the disaster in Haiti emerged, we managed to divert the equipment which was supposed to come to Geneva, and we diverted it to Santo Domingo, then to Haiti, and it is still there and operational. Please, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I think I also appreciate the minister's comments earlier, where he basically sort of provided the opening comment that there's an unfortunate sort of relationship between emerging developing markets where, for example, the fatalities are tremendously high for natural disasters versus in developing countries. In fact, the American Red Cross in 2008 said 99% of the fatalities for natural disasters were from developing countries. But there's another issue in developing countries, which is mobile communications. It's growing rapidly. It's basically the provision of access both to the voice network and increasingly the data network. So the issue, for example, mobile banking, where remittance and payments are growing tremendously in developing countries. And those are critical when a natural disaster occurs, to be able to get money to your family or friends and others as quickly as possible in the market. So there, of course, is the issue of trying to get the mobile networks up as rapidly as possible, which is critical. We were very pleased to work with the ITU and give a small donation to try to help the ITU and the UN first responders to use a mobile switch, mobile base station device that we have. It's a standalone device, but it also can be integrated into the mobile networks, or also providing IP outside with satellite communications. That we're very pleased with, and it's a small part, and it's critical to get the first responders as quickly as possible, but of course getting the commercial network up as soon as possible as well. Another issue that I just wanted to raise, since we're a technology company, is basically that in these natural disasters, another issue is power consumption. Haiti, one thing that Haiti had is that they had a poor power grid, so that they have their base stations basically relying upon diesel backup. Now, the problem in Haiti was that the ability to deliver the diesel fell apart, and then some of the networks that were up went down. On our side, Qualcomm side, we and others within the industry are basically sort of looking at how we make our mobile devices and also the infrastructure more efficient. For example, there's design and work being done in displays, which will make energy consumption 100% better than what it is now today for your display, which is one of the things that eats up most of your power on your mobile device. Improvements in battery life. Another issue is simply the universal charger. There's work been done here in the ITU and elsewhere. You know, in Haiti, when the buildings collapsed, everybody's charger is in their house. They couldn't access it. So there was this huge effort to get chargers back into Haiti to help supply these mobile devices, which is key. We're making improvements in processing for mobile devices, which again are much more energy efficient. And in the base station area, which we're not involved, but there are definitely areas with respect to trying to make improvements in the spectrum and efficiency of energy. So I think that we'll continue to see technology helping to support in the disaster communications area. And it's critical in the mobile side as we start to see the growth and use of mobile, both in our day-to-day lives. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, don't be misled by Tom when he says that we gave a small donation. It's over $500,000. You can see how rich some companies are, despite the financial crisis. But having said that, I give the floor to Jenai from ESRI. They do what we call geographical information systems. We believe in what we call multi-hazard approach. Whatever the disaster is, we use almost the same kind of solutions. And we use a multi-modal approach in terms of the technologies that we deploy. Geographical information systems helps you to do mapping. And to hear all about that, Jenai.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zabazaba. Well, you must be familiar already with geographic information, and I think that most of your governments and United Nations entities use already this type of technology, which actually today totally part of ICT. Knowing where people and things are is key for any disaster management and response cycle. You are all familiar with GIS, and the key word of it is really geography. Geography is nothing new for the human mankind. You know, the man has done this since ever. Neanderthal was location aware, probably, or definitely, and he probably did not invent the map, but he could locate and allocate and have a situational awareness of his environment. He could observe the environment, he could capture, he could organize and share the geographic observations he was doing with his friends, with his family, with his tribe, with the political structure that was available at these times. It was important then, I mean situational awareness, as it is today. It's simply a matter of survival. United Nations entities, NGOs, local and national governments, and the private sector are all doing this all the time to prepare and respond and to assess the damages and reconstruct. But often, the geographic information needed is loose or inexistent while it is most needed. The reason for that is that often, for economic reasons, the data is not collected. Often also, data or information is not available to the first responders. And who are the first responders, actually? Well, these are the emergency telecommunications people. The first things that you need to rebuild or to reestablish are communications in after a disaster. Data, mission critical information may sit somewhere, but it cannot be reached for several reasons. Technology is not one of these reasons today. We cannot blame technology for not being available to allow people to share their geographic information and their geographic knowledge. It contributes, but it's not the policy issue solver. So how can we actually be better prepared? Well, today, you know, many UN agencies, as I said, use GIS to prepare for the disasters and do what they call vulnerability assessment and to be better prepared. This is key to be faster and save lives when the disaster happens. So where is the map? Where is that map? Where is the in geographic information? This is the first question that everyone asks when on operations. And this question may be coming too late because people may not be prepared. There are several reasons for that, you know. A map is an intelligent piece of information. It is built with data that you have been collecting and that you have derived from a geographic analysis very often. This data is combined with other data sources like base maps or templates. In addition, a GPS will give you approximate location and the position of your assets. The GIS responders communities have learned three things from the recent disasters, and I would say mainly Haiti. It's really a case study today for many, many responders, especially on geographic information. They have learned that they had to be prepared, better prepared. So preparedness is key for faster response. We need to capture and maintain strategic data sets for threatened and fragile places like small islands and least developed states. Of course, this needs to be done everywhere, but it seems that the least developed places on this earth are also the most threatened by droughts, floods, landslides, and earthquakes and other calamities. Climate change is definitely affecting these countries more than it is affecting the so-called developed world. These countries and these areas are today the most vulnerable. They were already for many economic reasons that you know, but now they are because of the impact of climate change and the impact of the increase of major disasters. The second point is response. You know, the result of the many analyses need to be made available to first responders in an interoperable form, where they can be consumed and matched with other informations quickly. We have many examples of that, like roadblocks or damage assessment done by entities, UN entities or NGOs like UNITAR, UNISAT, ITACA, and many other organizations, academics and universities all over the world. But the third point, the third lesson learned, and things that we really saw as new, is the emergence of crowdsourcing. It's enabling the citizen or any person in the field to contribute to this, you know, geographic, to this description of the environment, this geography. We saw many initiatives. We call them voluntary geographic information. I will name OpenStreetMap. It was amazing to see how quickly, within hours or days, road data was collected in the cloud by just simple people and communities, and then made available to other communities almost on the spot. There was no road data on Haiti at that time, or no usable road data set of Haiti and Port-au-Prince. And of course, the emergence of social networks. You saw recently that Twitter, I don't want to advertise for any company here, but they have a new API called the GeoTweet, so that you can use tweet in a geographic manner, understanding, you know, where this type of contribution comes from. Is it relevant or not? The future will tell, but the technology is there and it can be mashed into this type of applications in the cloud. Like many others, Esri has contributed to the recent crisis, Haiti in particular, but also, of course, Chile and many others, with professional services, manpower, data resources, and software. With UN Spider, I hope you all know about UN Spider. If you don't, just ask us the question. We will explain you what UN Spider is. UN Spider has... and with GEOS, the Group of Earth Observation System of System, we have launched the Haiti GeoViewer prototype. It's an application totally built in the cloud. The data and information sources are Web 2.0 enabled. The scenario is the following. When the UN Charter for Major Disasters is activated, the application is configured for the concerned area. World Map Services and World Feature Services, these are acronyms for standards for geographic information sharing, are set up and matched in the cloud application. Tools for navigation and analysis are made available for immediate use. Satellites are tasked. When the first remote sensing images are captured, immediate analysis is performed and results are made available for first responders. Network disruptions like bridges, roads, damaged buildings, accessibility to health centers, populated places, area detection for logistics, etc. These are the type of information that we can rapidly get from remote sensing imagery. You know, that the first question to ask is, where are the communities in need? How can they be reached? And of course, what is the status of the infrastructures? When other data are made available, like aerial photography, it is immediately integrated as a service into the applications in the cloud. During a crisis, lots of data is created, but can hardly be accessed or used for several reasons. You know quite well, we've been discussing that for 2 days now. It's, of course, accuracy, compatibility, there can be bandwidth issues, lack of historical data to compare before and after that the disaster has happened. Existence of duplicated data sets, you don't know which one is the right one or the most up-to-date to be used. Local capacity, if ever available, are disrupted or destroyed, so that if any data set was available at that time, that would be very difficult to have a grip on it. That's exactly what happened with Haiti while the UN building collapsed. Of course, people were injured and people died, but also lots of information disappeared while it was most needed at the very moment. So most UN agencies, NGOs, and international organizations use geographic data and systems to organize their work. They're using a very practical level and often lack of support and understanding across the enterprise, the UN enterprise, I would say. So you can, each one of us can participate and leverage this work done by many in your organizations and add the value of GIS in your ICT practice. Our new collaboration with ITU, and I thank Dr. Zavazava for that, we have been discussions on many fields, on field data access and also data standard and interoperability. The aim is to deliver valuable ICT tools to prepare and respond and for long-term economic development. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think from this particular presentation, you brought up one interesting aspect that we had not quite addressed, the issue of climate change. If you close your eyes and you imagine a country like Maldives and how beautiful it is, and the threat that within the next 35 years, it is likely to disappear. Tuvalu within the next 45, 50 years is likely to disappear. Then you see the threat of climate change. But to monitor the environment, we need technologies, and those technologies are remote sensing, active and passive sensors, and also geographical information systems. So we have to marry these technologies with the telecommunications in order to bridge the last mile. Having said that, we have got two speakers. You may want to ask, how are we doing? I think we are doing pretty well. So they are going to have approximately about 10 minutes, and after that we'll open the floor. Get ready with your questions or your comments. I give the floor to ICT for Peace, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much also for bringing this very important topic into the process of WISIS follow-up leading up to 2015. I think this is very timely. What we have heard so far is that we're doing better and better in having tools and applications to do a better job in crisis management. I think that's very clear. Also, the minister pointed this out. But what we also heard this morning, especially by the last speaker, is that we are not doing such a good job in using the information properly and coordinating and using the information so that decision makers can make decisions in a very timely manner. Now, that's where we come in, ICT for Peace Foundation, which is a think tank which came out of the World Summit on Information Society. And since this is a little bit our child, allow me to talk about it, because I think it's very important, because we can use the process that we have here to advance some of the key issues that we are discussing here. As we remember, the World Summit on Information Society sort of designed a vision how the future information society should look like and how we can use these tools to better job in whatever we do, for development, for health, for education. And in that moment, at the end of the WISIS phase, Geneva, people came and said, but how about peace? How about crisis? I mean, these are ingredients necessary to reach the Millennium Development Goals. It's both, it's development, it's peace. And that's why in the second phase, leading up to the Tunis summit, we got together some experts and developed an inventory of new tools and applications who could help people who are in the business of prevention, mediation, early warning, protection of civilians, and so forth. And we published this booklet at that time as part of the UN ICT task force. We were able then, based on that, to have a paragraph 36 approved, allow me to be legalistic, technical, at the World Summit on Information Society in Tunis. The Tunis commitment is paragraph 36, which recognizes the value of the new tools in doing early warning, prevention, mediation, post-conflict reconstruction, and peace building. And I think we should all use these tools, these legal bases and others, to advance the cause. We then, after the Tunis summit, after approval of that, we were asked, what are we going to do now? What is this just, and who is going to implement this? And that's why we created this foundation with some eminent persons, with some great specialists. We have Martti Ahtisaari, Peace Nobel laureate. We have practitioners from the field like Sanjana Hatotua with us, or Dag Nielsen from Eric's Response. Also, Hans Zimmermann was involved in creating it. And we said, so what area should we focus on in this large field? And we decided to focus on crisis information management. And I think that word, crisis information management, encapsulates actually what I think we should focus on and try to improve. I mean, as I said, we have now many more tools to are available from satellite, and especially also the social networking tools, which provide enormous benefit to relief operations. On the other hand, but they also increase the number of information sources. And the decision makers who are in crisis are confronted with an enormous amount of information. And I think what is needed, and unfortunately, Haiti demonstrated that again, that people are confronted with enormous amount of information, which is good, but how do you choose, how do you validate to make the right decisions? For that reason, the foundation engaged with the UN Secretary General's office, especially with Dr. Choi, the Assistant Secretary General, Chief Information Technology Officer, to look how we could build a crisis information management strategy that would include the UN family first, but all partners, and see how we could bring in some and address some of the issues with regarding to information management. Information management meaning sharing information, collecting and sharing information about the needs, or in terms of preparedness, and then during the crisis and during the response time. And we were able to develop together with major organizations, including OCHA, and incidentally OCHA has been working in this field for many, many years. They have created this symposium. Some of you have been there in 2002, 2007. Many of the issues that we're discussing in crisis information management has been out there for some time, but it needs really political will with regard to get the leaders of organizations to be willing to share information, willing to develop a common data set, the technology, the stakeholder management, and the capacity building. And we all invite you to participate in this process, which is led by the UN Secretary General. With regard to Haiti, just a little bit pro domo, we were actually in Haiti before the disaster with Dr. Choi, the Chief Information Technology Officer, in December. and of course to prepare and discuss some of the issues of the strategy with the local, the SRSG, the deputy SRSG, and the force commanders and all the UN organizations there. And we were actually trying to see how we could be do a better job in Haiti as a pilot program. Unfortunately, we know what happened, but based on that knowledge of the local situation, we were then very early on able to develop a Wikipedia, a wiki on Haiti, which all the resources that were made available online. And when you go to this Wikipedia wiki on Haiti, you will see there's a great number of resources, and it shows again how difficult it is to make use of all that information. So our point is we need a better information management system, which political support, because we believe it can only be done if we have the political leaders to make their organizations work together better. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. I think even in the United Nations Charter, the word peace keeps on featuring in almost every para. So ICT for peace. Yes, please.
Can I say a word about the political will? Of course, the political will is the will of the people. And believe you me, nothing can stand against the will of the people. So it has to be a vibrant force of the people that will modulate the political will. And that is what is going to bring about democracies throughout the world. That is where you can diminish dictatorship and get an end of the utilitarian force which is putting the people in shackles. And here it is that the ITC and your technology can play the most vibrant role. So let us commit ourselves to imbibing the spirit of amongst the people so that the people can modulate and change the political will. And that is where the destiny of the globe and the people can be changed and we can have a better world. Thank you very much. I have to leave because I have a meeting, but certainly I'll be joining in the other parlors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable. Ladies and gentlemen, we have got the last speaker from Turaya. They are a key partner of ITU, and they are going to share with you, I think, something to do with the role of satellite technologies in terms of emergencies. As you know, in most cases, terrestrial networks are either disrupted or destroyed during disasters, and satellite communications will still be functional. You have the floor.
Thank you. Well, I would like to thank you first for inviting us to this panel, and we are very proud to be here and to hear from different delegates about how we can improve disaster management. Thuraya has been involved in many cases by providing this first emergency telecommunication services in different countries, and we are very proud about the level of support and cooperation with multiple governments. With regard to disaster management, Thuraya provides critical voice communication for relief teams, crucial in early warning, communication for disaster preparedness and risk mitigation. Usually when a disaster strikes, communication links are usually disrupted. So to disaster relief workers, these links are essential in accurately assessing the scale of the disaster and to ascertain where and how to relief operation can be initialized. First response can mean the difference between life and death. Thuraya's cutting-edge solutions in voice, data, and broadband communication services are very critical for both relief teams and disaster victims. Our network automatically increases signal availability in disaster hotspots as demand dictates. And Thuraya leading edge solutions give relief teams access to reliable high speed mobile satellites
broadband to access information, such as weather, mapping services, which are critical in relief efforts. Today, through ISRAP is rapidly deployable satellite communication solution that provides essential integrated framework to coordinate relief organization, emergency services, government outfit, and operating in different communication systems. We have also developed several conversion solutions, such as the NetEdCom services in case of disaster management, whereby you can have a convergent GSM radio and satellite communication to help and increase the efficiency of communication between disparate technologies. I think the most important part that Thuraya is providing is essentially the ease of use, the reliability, and the fastness with in deployment of the communication means. So I'd like to thank you, and I hope that we will have a more interactive discussion with all delegates. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, it's your turn now to speak. I'm going to summarize the presentations in about 2 minutes, and then I will open the floor for your comments and questions. We first heard from the director of the BDT, Sami Al-Bashir. He gave an overview of disasters that have been striking the world in recent months or recent years. The frequency has tended to increase. The magnitude and intensity of those disasters have been quite devastating. One of the things that he mentioned was the relevance of ICT and the World Information Society to disaster management. Universal access is the key word. From O'Keefe Kelly, she represents Iridium, which is a satellite company with 66 satellites, which are in constellation. And as a symbolical representation of the number of satellites they own, they gave us about 66 units of satellite terminals that we use to deploy across the world. And you have heard the use of satellite communications and its relevance in disaster management. We have also heard from Mark Moore of Calabria. He has summarized pretty much the need to harmonize telecommunication systems in the field. And ITU, as a standard-setting body, has got a number of standards that seek also to make sure that telecommunication networks interoperate. So the interoperability of telecommunication networks is one of the key elements. And to come to that also, we have a new standard which is called Common Alerting Protocol, so that when you press one button, you are able to reach out through any means of communication people who are in danger, and then you can use that for alerting. Having said that, we heard from Dr. Seppo Sisato, who comes from Finland. He talked about the need to make sure that the playing field is even. Technology is useless if you cannot deploy it. And then there is need to make sure that we have got the legal framework that is enforceable. So he talked about the Tampere Convention, the need to ratify it and to implement it. Then we heard from Thomas from Qualcomm. Yes, the name I'm avoiding to pronounce his name. It's a Polish name?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a difficult. I heard that in Poland, the more difficult the name is, the richer the person. So, so yes, we heard about the Qualcomm CDMA equipment and the partnership, the strong partnership that we have with them, and the fact that we just deployed their base station in Haiti. And they have been a very key partner of ours. From ICT4D, peace is all what we need, stability, the predictability of the future. And I think that is our founding fathers of the United Nations. In the United Nations Charter, even in the preamble, state clearly that we need peace and stability. And that is what we seek to protect. Having said that, the Honorable Minister spoke about his experience. It was a case study of Pakistan. We deployed telecommunications resources there, and one of the key elements that we did, we trained about 62 personnel to use broadband technology. And then the key element there was e-medicine. We trained 22 junior doctors went to the mountains, set up tents, set up temporary clinics, and we linked those with Karachi and other places so that senior doctors who could not travel to the site of the disaster could diagnose online. So I think he also mentioned the need for political will, and he says political will translates itself from the people's will. Having said that, Thuraya, they are our partners. They have been providing telecommunications equipment. What can I say? They are a very good organization in terms of providing humanitarian actors with telecommunication links when they are most needed. Then we heard from Steve Buckley, World Association of Communication, Community Radio. Community radio and radio amateurs face a big challenge across the world normally in terms of interfacing with the regulators. Normally it is very difficult to convince regulators to give licenses. But let me tell you a small story. In Albany and Catanduanes in the Philippines, they suffer from high-speed cyclones and typhoons every year, around June, July, August. And 2 years ago, there was a massive typhoon, and everything was down. When it was down, a 70-year-old priest, he had an antenna which was still hanging. He's a radio amateur. And he is the only one who managed to contact Thailand to talk to another radio amateur. And that gentleman, the gentleman in Thailand, is the one who managed to contact Manila so that they could go and respond to the disaster in Catanduanes and Albany. So you can see the role of this technology, but I know that it is difficult sometimes to convince the policymakers. Having said that, we heard from Emmanuel Genai, EMEA, Esri Europe, that there is need for us to have hybrid technologies. We must be able to map up, to understand the demographics. Let me put it simply. If you are in your office, a disaster strikes somewhere, you should be able, using these high-resolution satellite maps, to see the place before visiting that place, to understand the demographics, geographical disposition, to know how many villages there are and how many elderly people there are, gender, children, and so forth, so that you can deploy resources in a timely manner. Having said all that, I think I didn't forget anyone. I open the floor for your comments, for questions. Yes, sir.
Good morning, everyone. I'm from Chile, one of the two big catastrophes we had. I would like to go straight to three questions. It's not just about connectivity. We also must take into account data centers. One of the big things that happened in Chile was not only that connectivity was broken, which was restored quite pretty fast, but where we really had troubles were with data centers that went down with the earthquake, and hence, for example, the ATM machines in many of the banks did not work for a week. So if there's any ideas whatsoever about data centers. Second thing is, once settled connectivity is in place, in a disaster there is no applicable traffic model with either terrestrial or mobile communications. At Chile, we are right now debating on ways to overcome the overdemand that rises after the disaster has taken place. Amongst others, we are talking about limiting mobile comms to only SMS alone, or reducing time frame of conversations to, for example, 1 minute. Any ideas whatsoever? Finally, another key issue is regarding infrastructure for disasters. No economic model can support a fully capable disaster infrastructure with 100% redundancy without a substantial impact on prices to final consumers. So if there's any ideas on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will take about three questions, and then I will invite the floor and also the panelists to comment. Yes, over there, and I will come to Tunisia. So.
Thank you, sir. My question is to all of you. How attractive sound to you an idea of having, do you hear me? Okay. How attractive sound for you the idea to have in Africa, for instance, a common emergency number to be created, and will you support that idea?
Thank you very much. Europe, I think, is leading the European Union with 1112. And I know that in South Africa and a few other countries in Africa, they have adopted 112. And this is basically, if you allow me to comment, this is basically the identification or allocation of a one number for emergencies and at national level, so that people just dial one number, they don't have to memorize all sorts of numbers. But having said that, I think it is also critical that we make sure that we harmonize that number across the globe, so that when people are traveling, they don't have to start memorizing which number to call when they are in trouble. Tunisia.
Faisal Bayouli from Tunisie. Bon, de la Tunisie, je vais parler en français. Bon, il y a essentiellement deux points que je veux bon élaborer. C'est bon, d'une part, il ne faut pas attendre qu'on a une catastrophe pour mettre en place des mesures et des scénarios. Donc, il faut, je pense, il y a un travail en amont qui doit être fait pour se préparer et être très bon réactif en cas de catastrophe. Ça, je sais pas qu'est-ce qui se fait dans ce domaine-là. Et d'autre part, il y a un autre problème. Bon, je pense que on l'a vu un peu dans les catastrophes de Haïti et tout. Et c'est que il y a un manque de coordination entre les différents intervenants, c'est-à-dire entre les organismes des Nations Unies, et, la société civile et tout ça. Donc, je pense qu'il faut beaucoup de travail de coordination entre tous ces intervenants qui peuvent un peu s'organiser sous forme, je ne sais pas comment, sous forme de network ou d'organisme qui pour un peu, c'est ce qu'a dit M. Daniel dans ce sens. Et merci.
Merci beaucoup. I'm opening now. I think I'm closing the floor for a moment. Our panelists, do you have any comments? Yes, Kale.
Thanks. I guess a lot of them kind of cross into similar issues. Tunisia had brought up the question of preparedness, and I think preparedness goes into the question from Chile about redundancy and making sure as you're deploying infrastructure, rebuilding infrastructure, to have to kind of balance the interests of costs with redundancy. And I think in terms of preparedness, as long as I think disaster communications is an important aspect of planning for that infrastructure build out, and also taking the steps to coordinate between different agencies and identify what their true requirements are. I know I mentioned satellite communications as an important tool for offering that redundancy. And I think, especially when people are talking about broadband deployment, the focus is often on fiber or terrestrial wireless deployments, but satellite can offer a alternative that will provide redundancy instead of having maybe a redundant, terrestrial infrastructure, which would be a lot more costly. So I hope that helps at least in some account. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think I said it for peace. Oh, sorry. Okay, both of you.
Well, the name Wasilewski means son of a baron in Polish, and was basically taken by peasants to sort of try to have some link to royalty. On the data center issue, this is not an area of Qualcomm's, but my wife was in the data center business. Obviously, the key is, from a government perspective, one key I think is that I have seen that's unfortunate is requiring data centers to be in country. That's not necessarily always a good thing, obviously, if the data center is a country. So many of the larger server companies have redundancies. The company my wife worked with, they were in the provision of servers and located all over. So in essence, I think I'm not going to sort of say that it's a government action to sort of require redundancy, but clearly banking is critical because many people don't have insurance and need to access their own cash or get cash from other places. It's problematic in some more so in other countries. On the priority access issue on mobile networks, clearly you can look to countries that are doing priority access on mobile networks, giving first responders emergency communications quicker access. But there's a balance there because everybody has mobile services. They want to speak to the families. It has to be managed appropriately. And I think an example of that is yet duration of calls. limited to a certain amount of time. It makes much sense. But again, I think that that's really a government initiative that needs to be done in an open, transparent process, and relying upon the expertise across the world that have had to address this issue of priority access. That's comments on that issue. The other, I think that's fine. I'll stop there.
Fantastic. Thank you. I see the floor, please.
The ambassador from Tunisia for his pertinent remarks. I mean, that's the core issue. The second point, your second point, is preparedness. And of course, then be prepared during the crisis to exchange information. And I think, as I said before, I mean, we are doing in many areas a great job. Technology helps a lot. We have heard it today also from other. But I think we're not doing a good job. And what we believe that is needed, I mean, is a global strategy, and which includes, as I said before, four areas. One is the data architecture. What data actually do we want to need to share in preparedness? And there comes the issue of vulnerability. I mean, we cannot do it for everywhere at the same time, but we could say, let's say, these are the countries who are vulnerable, the most vulnerable. Let's start with those and then get prepared in terms of mapping and so forth, and getting the definitions right, the names of the cities, the roads, where are the hospitals, things that can be done and should be done. But we are not doing it. I'm sorry to be the one who is be the bad guy, but we're not doing it enough. And we are all part of it. We're part of the problem, and everybody recognizes the problem. And so what we're trying to do is, within that strategy, first to get the core data set that are needed to be prepared, and that then we have to share information. Second is the technology base, because now we have so many technologies, platforms. Each organization uses even now the new networking tools, the social networking tools as well. So we have a multiplication of the tools as well. Third is the stakeholder management. Who should be involved in this process? And of course, everybody, but how, it's too many, how to structure it and so forth. And fourth, like the lady said at the other end, I mean, it's capacity building. In order to implement such a strategy, you need to train people, because it's a new field. People don't are accustomed to work together as much as one would. So I would say that is the direction that we should go. If I just make a little announcement, we have tomorrow a deeper discussion on technologies and based on the experience in Haiti. Tomorrow it's a thematic workshop from 9 to 11 in room L, where we have outstanding practitioners from Ushahidi, from Ocha, Sanjana Hatotua, and others will be there tomorrow morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I give the floor to the director of the BG team, Ms. Samia Al-Bashir.
Well, thank you. I think the panelists have answered the question, and these are pertinent questions. I think what we are saying here, we are not saying that the international effort is to replace the national and local efforts. Each community, each country at the national level and the local level, they should have, and we encourage them to have, their own emergency plans in case of a disaster. And this is where we come from the international community to complement this. And I think experience showed us that even a country like the United States needed help during disaster, and just to mention the biggest countries, China and so on and so forth. So there is no small or LDC countries or big countries in terms of disaster. We all have to work together, and this is why in the ITU we are proud to work with all these partners and others. And I assure you, and this is the reason I took the floor, that in about a week time or a little bit more in Hyderabad, when I am going to open the World Development Conference, we already have some proposals from the membership, from both public and private, to even do more in this area, in emergency communication. That's why we are aiming to have a global standalone program for this in order to go a step further, not only to coordinate on the international level, but also to give our international expertise to help countries, individual countries, to have their own emergency response and communication and emergency communication in case of a disaster. I think what I'm saying is we need all efforts to be put together, and no country, no community can do it alone. That's why we are grateful to this international collaboration from all stakeholders to accomplish the job. And as it's been said, for cost and for other reasons, you cannot have 100% redundancy. That's why we need these kinds of plans. I think we have some more people here asking.
Thank you very much. I think we have two last panelists who wanted to make comments before we open. Yes, Janai, please.
Thank you very much. Well, most of the answers were brought, but I want to thank you. My answer is preparedness, preparedness, preparedness. And I just give you a quick example. You can have the most performing early warning system if you don't know where the people are. And I'm talking about illegal settlements, for instance. And you know that most of the human mankind lives near seashores. And this is where they're most threatened by tsunamis, for instance. So if and this is also where voluntary geographic information comes into place, so that people need to be enabled. We heard before about democracy. It's also a human right, that we said yesterday, to be able to be located. It's quite funny to think that we in Europe think that we want to the human right for us is the possibility to be hidden and not be located, while for most people in developing countries, it's critical to be located, and knowing where people are can really save lives. People are moving, you know, illegal settlements are not there forever. They may be moved from some other places, but these people have the same rights than any other one. So mapping and knowing where things are really mission critical, I think, and this is part of preparedness. And then on the problem of the cash flow that you brought up, sir, very important, very difficult to restart an economy where people don't get the cash and the ATMs are broken. So where are the open ATMs? Where is the money that can be retrieved to then be reinvested to reconstruct? This is another location-based service, actually, that I see, and it's also part of preparedness to have, you know, this information beforehand, before it happens. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The last panelist to comment on this is Sepa.
Thank you very much. I will be very short, try to be very short, and raise up what you mentioned about volunteer activities and especially radio amateurs activity in the cases of emergencies. There are 2.5 million radio amateur operators in the world. That's a big number of volunteer people for MCOMs. And since last decade, we have had these GAREC conferences, we have had a global simulated emergency tests twice a year, and having these, we try to increase common interest among amateur radio operators for MCOMs, and to get us better prepared for MCOMs, changing information. Also, we have given recommendations and statements like center of activity frequencies, etc. So this means that it's a very valuable source for fast, flexible, less vulnerable MCOMs. And I think that it's we have a very good reason to raise up also these opportunities in this forum, because volunteer work is also always very valuable, and we can't say that amateur radio operators, we can take care of 2 weeks operation, but we are very effective, fast first aid. And one thing I would like to say, because we have mentioned here a loss of national creed in the case of emergency, we have very good tools against that. As far there are cars, we can get feed our radios from car batteries, etc. So we have a lot of solutions, simple solutions, and we can also use those. This is not just talking about it. We are doing it every day. So just reminding you about this opportunity. And still one thing, we have now a plan for project called ENARSA. That's MCOM network by amateur radio service for Africa. And if we will raise up some funds, so we are trying to build up something new for Africa, because most of amateur radio operators are in USA, Japan, EU countries, and Africa is a wide area of our hobby. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I just realized that Steve wanted to take the floor at this point. So what I will do, Steve, if you bear with me just a second, I'll open the floor. You are going to take the floor first. You can choose to answer only questions related to the first lot of questions or go into the next ones, if you allow. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Gerardo Goshi. I work for Geneva International Center for Humanitarian Demining. I just wanted to confirm the words that Dr. Daniel Stauffacher mentioned about the strategy on crisis information management, as well as the word asked of the Mr. Sami Al-Bashir about the coordination with local governments and empowering them to be able to themselves deal with the crisis. My expertise or my experience comes from another disaster, the natural disaster. I actually worked, or my organization, we work with man-made disaster, actually landmines and cluster munitions. We have developed a tool, which is a part of the, which Dr. Daniel and as well Mr. Chennai, they are well known with the tool. It's called Information Management System for Mine Action, with acronym IMSMA. That tool is for free, and our center gives it to local governments, so they will be able to manage the disaster of mines. We've done that in emergency responses, like in Georgia and Kosovo. We've done it as well in the long-term development countries, like in Cambodia and Angola. The tool works that the data architecture is already sorted out, because it contains the geographical information. It contains information about stakeholders. And as well, when we provide the tool, we enforce the capacity development of the people there. We invite the people from the countries, affected countries, to give the training in Geneva, or we send our experts there to conduct the training. I think this is something, talking about, we just been approached by IMAP, which are our implementing partner, and they are currently in Haiti. If we can modify the IMSMA to be more to the development side of the, rather than only to the mine action. Last week we started the test, and next week we're going to test it in our office to see how the approach. We already have the frame for that one. So I think that we have a great experience in managing this issue, which we are really willing to share with you in all the levels. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have got about 5 minutes, so let's keep our contributions as short as possible so that we can all have an opportunity to speak. Yes, sir.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Comme vous savez, l'Algérie a été frappée depuis une trentaine d'années. Elle a été frappée trois fois, notamment par... Enfin, une dizaine de fois, mais trois fois de manière cruciale, puisque nous avons eu des tremblements de terre, deux, qui ont causé des milliers de morts. Nous avons eu également un tremblement de terre, une inondation qui a causé également un millier de morts. Bon, cela veut dire que, bien entendu, la nature a sa part de responsabilité, mais l'homme également a sa part de responsabilité. Il ne construit pas selon des normes de construction. Il donne des autorisations pour construire des maisons dans des zones inondables, dans des zones très sensibles, sans respecter les normes. Il déforeste, donc il enlève les forêts, il les détruit. Il y a donc des érosions qui créent des catastrophes naturelles. Bien entendu, l'homme est responsable. Il n'y a absolument aucun doute. Et je suis d'accord avec Sami Al-Bashir qui dit qu'il y a plusieurs échelons dans les interventions. Il y a l'échelon local, national, et puis il y a l'échelon international, régional et international. À l'échelon national, on peut faire énormément de choses. D'abord, déjà, faire respecter les normes. Et puis, je suis d'accord avec ce que disait M. Djenaï, tout réside dans la préparation. Il faut absolument se préparer. Bon, je donne quelques exemples en Afrique. Ça n'est pas tout à fait le désert, puisque nous avons créé une constellation de satellites d'observation de la Terre. Il y a 3 pays qui participent pour le moment. Il y a l'Afrique du Sud, le Nigeria et l'Algérie. J'espère que d'autres pays pourront également venir avec des satellites d'observation de la Terre. Au niveau des pays arabes, nous avons dans le pipe, malheureusement, bon, ça va un peu plus lentement, mais je sais que quand ça se décidera, ça ira vite. Il y a un satellite ASEO, Arab Satellite for Earth Observation. Donc, ça a l'air de marcher. Au plan international, nous sommes avec 6 autres pays dans une DMC, Disaster Management Constellation. Donc, ça marche. Maintenant, vous savez qu'il y a des puissances de ce monde qui sont capables chaque jour de lire la marque du dentifrice qu'on utilise chaque matin à partir des satellites. Et ces mêmes puissances de ce monde ont été, comme l'a dit M. Samuel Bachir, ont été touchées. C'est-à-dire qu'elles ne sont pas exemptes de ces risques, puisque les États-Unis connaissent actuellement, vivent une catastrophe d'une ampleur terrible. Il y a des écosystèmes qui sont détruits, qui sont en voie de destruction. En tout cas, moi, j'espère que ces écosystèmes seront préservés, la Chine, etc. Alors ma question, et je l'adresse à tous, politiciens, techniciens, technologues, etc. Est-ce qu'enfin, on va prendre réellement conscience? Et je suis radioamateur, moi aussi, je ne sais pas, 7 X-ray Oscar Mike, c'est moi, dans les années 80, je perturbais un peu les ondes des radioamateurs, mais dans le bon sens, bien entendu. Donc, je pose la question à tous, est-ce qu'enfin on va prendre réellement conscience qu'il faut mettre tous ces moyens à la disposition de l'humanité, parce que des moyens, il y en a, mais on les utilise pour d'autres fins. Est-ce qu'on réserve 5%, 10% de ces capacités pour pouvoir les mettre à la disposition de l'humanité? Merci.
Merci beaucoup, monsieur. Steve, can you respond to this and we might close after you.
Thanks, yes. Well, I wanted to respond on the preparedness issue, strategies for dealing with that, but particularly to focus on the radio question. And my interest in responding was inspired particularly by the intervention from our friend from Chile. We undertook a survey in Chile after the earthquake of 70 community radios across the disaster-affected area. Around about 15 of them were seriously damaged and came off the air. About 10 of those lost their buildings. Another 40 or so, although they were directly affected, were able to carry on broadcasting. And what is interesting about FM radio is that it is very resilient. It's not part of a chain. It's their standalone entities, and they're not very difficult to get back up and running again. And most people continue to have access to an FM radio receiver in their house that works, even though their mobile phone system may not work. So I want to stress the importance of FM radio as part of the mix. And I want to mention that it's not a costly thing to have functioning, but the principal barriers are ones often of legislation and regulation. This has been the case in Chile, where community radios operate in a very limited way, very, very low power. Sometimes they're closed down for exceeding that power. There has been progress on media reform in that country. But this is not the only example. In Indonesia, there was very little community radio in Aceh before the tsunami. But after the tsunami, people realized how important it was to have it there. And there were 75 community radios established in the space of about 18 months, part of the Aceh Reconstruction Radio Network. In Bangladesh, community radio licensing started last month, and one of the drivers for the government taking the decision to open up the airwaves to a more pluralist environment has been precisely a consciousness that these radios can play in a very important role in disaster response, particularly the threats of flooding and sea inundations that there are in Bangladesh. It's not expensive, but there are often barriers of political will to see more diversity and more local and community-based radio established. And I would urge all governments particularly that have not yet opened up the airwaves to allow community radio to establish, to look at ways in which they can do so. And if they are operating but only in a limited way, to look at ways in which they can be encouraged and promoted and enabled to operate at higher power and to be more effective in their role in disaster response and disaster preparedness.
Thank you very much. Last word.
This is just a response to the questions from the gentlemen from Tunisia and Chile. My name is Olaf Mittelstedt. I'm from the DAISY Consortium. We are the developers and maintenance agency for an accessible multimedia standard. And one of our members in Japan, in order to highlight the possibilities of that standard in disaster preparedness and disaster reaction, showcased that with a village called Urakawa, which sits on a quake fault. And it was a community-based and institution-based effort to produce response material in a multimedia form. It synchronizes images, videos, and audio and text in one format. And this information rests on the mobile phones of that of every member in that community. In order to highlight that, the possibilities for handicapped people, that information was also produced by us, by the patients of a psychiatric ward. They produced their own material in order to how to react in case of a tsunami. Now, since it is a multimedia standard, that information not only rests on the mobile phones of the of that community and the patients in that psychiatric ward, but parts of it, the audio, the video, the text, can be distributed separately by other media.
Thank you very much for those words. Sami, do you want to take the floor?
That will. Thank you very much. I know we're past our time, but this shows the interest of this very important topic, and I'm really grateful for all the panelists, for all of you, for your presence, for your dedication, for sharing the experiences with us, and for your interactive discussion and question. Mm-hmm. The only thing remaining to me to say is to invite you all to join us in Hyderabad on the 24th of this month, a very short time from now, and where this issue will going to be, as I said, high on the agenda, where we have already over 1,000 people registered for this conference. Most of them are high level from the industry, and also many ministers, over 70 ministers going to be there, in addition to very high level dignitaries from all over the world to discuss development issues. But this topic is going to be high on the agenda. So I will be grateful if you can join us, all of you there. And this is a last minute invitation to everybody to come and join. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Can we thank our panelists? And thank you very much for bearing with us through this whole 2-hour session without taking a coffee. Thank you.